Welcome to the HC Insider Podcast, a podcast dedicated to the commodities sector and the people within it. I'm your host, Paul Chapman. Today we are talking de-dollarization. Could the US dollar lose its status as the global reserve currency? If so, why? What are the alternatives? And what does that mean for commodities, and what does that mean for the world? Our guest is Jonah Van Borg. Jonah was a crude oil derivatives trader at Goldman Sachs, then a partner at Vitol, and then led crypto and precious metals at DRW, and is now launching a systematic trading practice at Onyx Commodities. Jonah's also the co-host of the 1000X podcast, a podcast on crypto and broader macroeconomics. Also, we have our next HC Insider Podcast live event coming up on April 16th in Geneva to celebrate the launch of HC Group's office there to discuss the future of Switzerland as a commodities trading hub. The event starts at 6:30 with a live panel recording and then cocktails and networking afterwards. The event's free, but is RSVP only and seats are limited. I'll put links in the show notes for those who wish to attend. As always, you can really support this podcast by leaving us a positive review on the platform you're listening on, or 5 stars, or even a thumbs up on YouTube. It really does help support the show. And as always, I hope you enjoy the episode. Jonah, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
So we are talking de-dollarization and your thesis around that and what the causes might be and what the impacts might be. I guess let's start at the start, which is the US dollar is currently the reserve currency of the world. Can you give us some sense of what that means and what underpins it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think it's, we all learn about Bretton Woods in history class and how, you know, the history behind what happened in the wake of World War II, how global trade was secured by the United States, and how, you know, this system of pegged exchange rates and the dollar being convertible into gold became sort of a global standard. Now, you know, you hear those things when you're a student and they don't really resonate. But for me, when I was working at, you know, this physical commodities trading house called Vitol, suddenly it all became very obvious just how important the dollar is in terms of global trade. When you literally sit at the beating heart of an organization that shifts around these gigantic cargoes of crude oil, and you watch the dollars flow back and forth between the developed world, where commodities, you know, are often in deficit, and the, you know, emerging markets where there's a surplus of commodities, you start to understand how the dollar is the lubricant of global trade and what it really means to be sort of a global reserve currency. It's the denominator of every single one of these transactions. Just a quick note on reserve currencies. I actually posted this on Twitter. It's kind of like a pie chart, but it's a movie where every frame is a year, and you can watch the different currencies of the world, the, you know, dominant currencies over time, and their market share as the denominator of global trade change throughout time. So the dollar is not going to be the reserve currency of choice forever, just as it wasn't forever in the past. And there have been many global reserve currencies over time. Most recently, before the dollar, is actually the British pound that was the most used reserve currency for global trade.
Yeah, and then can you give us some sense of what qualities a currency needs in order to start being elevated to that reserve currency status? What are traders, transactions? What is the globe looking for?
Well, you need a superpower to secure the trade lanes that transact in dollars. That's kind of not something that people really have thought about for a long time, because, you know, since World War II, the general picture of waterborne trade has been one of stability. But ultimately, it, for the longest time, it was the U.S. Navy that sort of secured that. So you need the country whose currency is the global reserve currency to kind of secure the trade lanes that are transacted in that currency. You also need a robust sort of growing economy underneath that currency. You need stable interest rates. And most importantly, and this is what's coming sort of into question lately with the dollar, you need the monetary and fiscal powers that be in that country to act in a friendly, transparent, predictable way towards not just their friends and allies, but also towards the economies and countries and governments that they may not necessarily agree with, but who transact in the currency. So in this case, it's the US dollar. And I think in the recent sort of last year or two, what we've seen with the Ukraine war is that Russia, a major oil exporter, their petroleum trades in dollars just as much as petroleum from Texas trades in dollars. And the government of the United States has begun to weaponize the dollar against Russia because it does not agree with Russia's foreign policy. And, you know, we could debate perhaps on another podcast whether or not that's the right thing to do, but it jeopardizes the status of the dollar in a major way as the global reserve currency of choice.
And part of a broader suite of sanctions globally, really in the last 15 years that have been enacted. There's a couple of elements, though, to this, right? One is the, let's call it domestic policy, macroeconomics, and then the other is this, the deglobalization, the weaponization, to use your term, of the dollar, which is setting up and, you know, and has been a topic of discussion for in the recent past, but also part of, a broader, having lived in America, right, there's a sort of a general sense at any moment that things are going to be on the decline. So we'll keep that in mind on this discussion. But staying on kind of, the domestic side or the macroeconomic side, one of the challenges with the dollar right now is, of course, high interest rates, higher cost of capital, certainly compared to, in particular, the renminbi of China, which is having an impact to some degree. Can you sort of give us some sense of how interest rates play into this as a former currency trader, and I guess also that domestic policy volatility as well, which is giving some people pause for thought about how well Congress and the Fed are custodians of those dollars that they might be keeping under their mattress globally.
Yes. Well, with interest rates, I actually don't think that high interest rates are a problem. I think that volatile interest rates are a problem. So high interest rates actually tend to, lead to strength in a currency. The basic math for people who haven't traded currencies is that, let's say that interest rates in America are higher than interest rates in Japan. You're incentivized to go borrow Japanese yen, swap them into dollars, and then lend those dollars out in America. And that's called the carry trade. That sort of is why currencies with high interest rates appreciate relative to currencies with low interest rates. So it's not necessarily a bad thing to have high, or moderately high interest rates like we have now in the United States. It contributes to dollar strength. And that dollar strength means that, let's say that you are warehousing, billions or trillions of dollars worth of treasury bonds. Those notes pay higher yields and your dollars don't necessarily depreciate. What's difficult to deal with is very volatile interest rates, which correspond with, rapid regime change or economic troubles. Equally, what I think is the worst case scenario is when you have sort of a 2021 type scenario in the United States, where not only are interest rates at zero, but there is profligate US dollar money printing going on, which debases the currency, punishes lenders, ultimately a major percentage of the holders of US Treasury bonds or foreign governments. They don't like having their investments devalued and their stake, their dollarized stake, their petrodollars devalued. So ultimately, super low interest rate, high stimulus environments are bad for the dollar. High interest rates or moderate interest rates, not so bad. And interest rate volatility makes things difficult. But in terms of, all of that aside, all of that sort of, interest rate conversation and its relationship with the dollar as a global reserve currency kind of pales in comparison to the impact of what I would call financial nuclear warfare that the United States and its allies effectively declared on Russia at the outset of the Ukrainian war. And then again, recently, they're discussing doing something even crazier, which I think would be very detrimental to the dollar.
Before we talk specifically about that, and there's always sanctions are certainly a double-edged sword. What are the mechanisms? Like, how is it that it is obviously the global reserve currency, but what are the mechanisms, the processes that underpin global transactions that means you can weaponize the dollar to that extent?
Well, there are a couple. The first is, as we discussed before, military security for global trade lanes, but more importantly, just on a kind of a microeconomic level, you have payment rails. So every currency needs decent payment rails. And I witnessed this again when I was, you know, adjacent to the physical crude oil business at Vitol. Let's say that a cargo of oil, which originates in Nigeria, wants to sort of get bought by a Chinese refinery in the Shandong province, right? Dollars end up getting paid from China to Nigeria, and those payment rails, which provide kind of an avenue for the dollars to flow from China to Nigeria. Nigerian banks then, you know, take those dollars and distribute them within Nigeria or swap them into Nigerian Naira, into sort of local economies. Like, those payment rails are okay. They're not great. Transactions settle sometimes a few days or possibly a week or two after the cash is initially wired from one economy to the other. Neither China nor Nigeria denominate anything other than their sort of global trade in dollars. Their local economies are denominated in yuan and naira, respectively. But one thing that's very important for a global reserve currency like the dollar is to have U.S. dollar payment rails everywhere, right? To sort of have these avenues, these pathways for dollars to flow between economies that ultimately don't really have much to do with the dollar other than global trade. The other thing that's you know, sort of the final thing that I would say is very important as well is kind of a way to store these dollars securely. And that's currently what's under threat, as are the payment rails in many respects. But once you have those dollars, those petrodollars from selling commodities, you have to be able to store them somewhere, and you have to bank and you have to keep them. So I think that's a really essential component of what it takes for a reserve currency to catch on. And back in the day, before Nixon, you know, removed the gold standard, it used to be a prerequisite for global trade that you could ultimately swap your global reserve currency into something of commoditized hard value like gold. That is no longer the case as we enter the world of fiat, the age of fiat.
With respect to those payment rails, but also the ability to store, which is in both cases with Russia, with those Russian sanctions, has been impacted, right? One is you've had huge amounts, $300 billion worth frozen, but also the payment rails themselves have been tampered with.
Precisely. So I think it is to be expected that when, you know, that you have sort of this hemispheric clash of powers, you know, United States and Europe versus Russia and China, it kind of makes sense that the rails which perforate those sort of Orwellian hemispheres can become fractured, right? And so I don't think it was much of a surprise to anybody when, you know, at the outset of the Ukraine war, the United States, I believe it was the Treasury, severed Russia's access to SWIFT, which is a major sort of important payment rail for U.S. dollars and a major contributor to petrodollar hydrocarbon trade. So that wasn't really a surprise. What was a shock, and which I would consider sort of the act of financial nuclear warfare that crossed us all into new territory, and I think might be the opening salvo of the end of the U.S. dollar as the world's global reserve currency, is that the United States Federal Reserve, the ECB and the SNB, just took Russia's dollars, Swiss francs, and euros, just froze them. And I think that it's one thing to say, hey, you have your dollars, but you're going to have a harder time moving them around. It's another to just say those aren't your dollars anymore. That suddenly calls into question the viability of the dollar as a denominator for global trade, because now it doesn't matter whether you're a staunch ally of the United States like Great Britain, or, you know, a sworn enemy like I guess Russia at this point, or even China. If you're holding US dollars or US treasuries, you don't really have much of a choice other than to think about what's going to happen the first time you do something that America and American politicians don't like. Are they just going to steal your money? It's unheard of. So ultimately, this is sort of the equivalent of, you know, warfare in the Middle Ages when marauders would just rob the gold from the enemy's vault, right? It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. How much? Because right now, as we talk, there's consideration about those $300 billion going to Ukraine. But what amazes me is that there hasn't seemed to be much discussion about what a seismic event this was. And as you say, for all those foreign lenders that have propped up the low interest rates in the United States and the amount of borrowing the United States can do, whether you're friend or foe, as you highlight, I mean, that's a pretty seismic, significant shift. How much discussion is going on about this internally to the US and externally?
I couldn't agree with you more. It is a seismic shift. And I was shocked by how little discussion was going on in sort of the broader, aside from a headline or two. I thought there would be ongoing discussion, conversation, you know, people with their hair on fire freaking out about this, but there hasn't been. And I think the world at large doesn't realize just how much this is, you know, a historic event and the beginning of a massive sea change in, you know, global trade and reserve currency status. So it's going to matter to everybody. It's going to matter to all 8 billion people, I think. And the reason why is, okay, let's say that you're China, right? You're watching this happen to Russia. You're holding something like $10 trillion worth of treasury bonds or thereabouts. Can't remember the exact number. You're going to have to, you know, if you're interested in maybe trying to annex Taiwan or do something even 10% as aggressive as that through the eyes of the West, you're going to have to literally face the idea of losing trillions and trillions of dollars worth of, you know, your national treasure. So before they go and do anything rash, they're going to first start letting some of those securities roll off and mature, and then they're going to have all these dollars they don't want. There's not a whole lot of other places to put that kind of wealth other than US dollars or American companies like the S&P 500, for example. I guess you could distribute it globally, but if you have that many trillions of dollars to deploy, you're going to have to start thinking about alternatives. And one thing that we were talking about extensively when I was running crypto at DRW, crypto trading, was Bitcoin isn't even a dark horse anymore for, you know, what's the next big asset that a government might consider if it were looking to protect its national assets against the backdrop of kind of an inimical, predatory U.S. Treasury and U.S. Federal Reserve. It's, you know, you're kind of running out of options, and you start to think about things like Bitcoin.
You know, we're doing a good job of burying the lead here, but just staying, because you are quite right. One of the points at the moment is, you know, it might be pretty bad, but it's all we've got, right? There are no, at the moment, viable alternatives to the US dollar as the global reserve currency. And I wanted to spend a little moment talking about the alternative currencies out there and why they aren't necessarily fit for the bill. Just before we move on to that, it's worthwhile just painting a picture of what would happen if, over the next decade, because at the moment the US dollar is still the reserve currency, some 56% of transactions are done in it for the reasons we mentioned at the start. But were it to start to really lose that status, and I imagine it's one of those things like bankruptcies where it's you know, goes all slow and then all of a sudden you know, it would have dramatic impact on, you know, the fact is that the US economy is growing better than any other economy and can bear such an incredible amount of debt by function of the fact that it is a reserve currency. And you could see just disastrous long-term consequences, kind of what we saw, as you said, the last time a nation lost its status as holding a reserve currency, the UK. You know, you went from a period of the 1910s, you know, dominating global trade, dominating global wealth, to by the midpoint of that last century, becoming a second-rate power and going through about a 40-year depression when you step back and looking at it from the long view. Can you just give us some sense of how significant this would be for the U.S.?
Oh, it would be a disaster for the U.S., which is why I'm personally so shocked that they're pursuing these incredibly predatory and ultimately unnecessary strategies. I think they're ultimately just shooting themselves in the foot. I think that if you are the sort of de facto superpower whose currency is used as the global reserve currency, you have this tremendous backstop, right? When things go south with your own economy, you can still borrow from the entire world because, you know, not only are there payment rails set up to borrow and lend in dollars globally, but also countries and foreign companies, you know, governments and international, you know, sort of commodities trade, all of this stuff is denominated in dollars. So there are dollars to lend, and people ultimately have some skin in the game. They have a stake in maintaining a sense of order and helping out the, you know, the global reserve currency on which they rely, right? Often in some of these more emerging economies, if the dollar starts to go a little bit haywire, you can see what happened, you know, in 2008 or even in 1931 during the Great Depression, when a major global superpower whose currency is a global reserve currency starts to, you know, incur economic wobbles, emerging markets are the first things to tank, right? So everybody has a stake in the success of the hegemon whose currency is the global reserve currency. And so there's this tremendous reservoir of liquidity and support and just a broader kind of backstop that America in this case can fall back on when things are going wrong. And if they abuse the dollar and people start to, you know, take the years and decades that it takes to migrate away from the dollar, the next economic crisis that hits America, they might find that they have a lot less padding and a lot less sort of economic theory behind what the Fed can do to sort of cushion the fall. And ultimately, I think the last few major economic shock events that you know, you and I have seen, I guess we're talking COVID, maybe a bit of a blow up in 2018, a taper tantrum earlier in the decade, the great financial crisis of 2008, the emerging market crises of the 90s and the stock market bubble crashing in 2000, like September 11th, all of these major sort of blow-up events that we've seen in the last, let's call it, quarter of a century, you know, the dollar has been very firmly entrenched and the global economy has been a very robust backstop. You know, as interest rates fall and the dollar weakens, America can export more when it needs to the most, increasing its customer base. Everybody's got dollars ready to buy. Petroleum becomes cheap for the whole world, you know, as the U.S. demand center sort of wanes a little bit, then that stimulates sort of green shoots on the other side, global growth. Like, it's all kind of dollar centric and commodity centric. And if everybody's pissed off at the dollar and develops their own sort of hemispheric ways to circumvent using the dollar for global trade, then America won't have that cushion. And, you know, maybe there won't be a well-tested playbook for the Fed and for the federal government to, you know, pull out the next time there's a crazy crisis and people have turned their backs on the dollar. In fact, the next crisis may be caused by that. Ultimately, it's something to be very wary of because the outcomes could be so catastrophic.
Yeah. Whatever it is at the moment, $30 trillion worth of debt will suddenly become extraordinarily expensive for the US people, not just the world.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. Yeah, you can service your national debt a lot more easily when everybody's willing to lend to you versus when they aren't. So that's not necessarily just going to go away, that problem.
No, which would be an absolutely, you know, the timelines on paying that off, just the sheer scale of it, right? When you've got a reducing, shrinking economy, you've got higher interest rates as a result of no one wanting to buy your currency. I mean, it would be catastrophic. Let's talk about alternatives, right? And obviously, we've already trailered that we're leading up to your case for crypto. But you've got, I think, sort of at the moment, you know, you've got various efforts around the world to try and remove the dollar from transactions, notably with China, particularly around its Belt and Road Initiative. But there are significant headwinds to the renminbi being a reserve currency, not least, as we talked about the first half of the discussion, you know, some of those attributes, right, transparency and so forth, are, however bad they are with the dollar, they're a lot worse in terms of China. Can you just give us some sense of why you don't think there's an alternative currency out there, another fiat solution?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, what are you looking at here? Which economies could support global reserve currency status? You have nothing individually within the European Union, but the EU itself could theoretically be, you know, the euro could be a global reserve currency. The Chinese renminbi could be a global reserve currency. And, you know, I guess in terms of other major G10 currencies, you have the Swiss franc, you have the British pound, which for a very long time was the world's global reserve currency. At one point, it had 85% market share, I think shortly after.
Backed by gold.
Yeah. Yeah. Right after World War I, it was about 85%, which incidentally was also the dollar's peak in the late 1990s.
And combined with the Blue 85%. Water Navy, right? I mean, that's the bit that Europe doesn't have right now.
Correct. So, yeah, and then I guess there's the Japanese yen. So I think we can throw out the yen and the Swiss franc pretty quickly. I mean, Switzerland's tiny. You're beholden to sort of an opaque government and regulatory system. It's a bit shadowy. I don't think you can run the entire global economy on whatever is going on in Switzerland. That's more of a niche. It serves its purpose, but global reserve currency is not that purpose. I think the most it's ever had is a few percentage points of global trade. Then the Japanese yen, again, I think it's a bit, the economy is a bit too small for the Japanese yen. And also the lack of a blue water navy or even much of an army to speak of, I think is a problem for that one. It's the Japanese have their own problems with regional tension with North Korea and China. They're not going to be securing global trade for everybody. The British pound, possible, unlikely. I mean, it does have, yeah, it has historical significance, and it still maintains a significant share of global trade. But yeah, I think the empire's kind of in the past now. And so what are you left with? You're left with the euro, the dollar, or something else, something new. And the dollar's on the wane for reasons we've, you know, beaten on about. But the euro, I think they would have an easier time. When I say they, I mean, you know, the European government in Brussels sort of presiding over the EU's ultimately a peace project, right? I think they would have a real claim to global trade and a claim to global reserve currency status if they had some sort of a military like UN type organization backing them. And if they could just agree on stuff and not look like they're about to fall apart every few years. You know, there was the Greek crisis, then Brexit. Now you have this rising tide of nationalist leaders from, you know, Meloni in Italy to, you know, Le Pen chomping at the bit in France after Macron runs his course. You know, Merkel's gone. And there's, you know, more extremist parties rising in Germany. The EU just doesn't look like it's necessarily going to remain in its current form for even a decade or two, let alone the sort of century plus that you have to envision if you're going to redenominate all of your global hydrocarbon trade into somebody's currency. So I think it's a problem that it's a consortium of countries, you know?
And if you look at the various crises in Europe, they're all as ultimately a result of a single currency, but not a single fiscal policy, right? You know, you look at the Greek crisis, a lot of it is by, ultimately, everyone was borrowing essentially at Germany's exchange rate, interest rate. And until you get that piece right, true fiscal union and political union, you're going to always have these various crises, I imagine, pop up. You have just imbalances within the euro, within the region.
Yes. So it's, you know, a sort of a makeshift peace project type organization without one unified national identity and national ambition and national purpose. It's kind of hard to see how, especially how antagonistic they've been to, you know, their own enemies and foes throughout the recent past. Like it's sort of hard to see them maintaining internal cohesiveness, let alone sort of a fair, even-handed, unchanging, unwavering policy towards other governments of the world that may be inimical to their interests, you know?
Yeah. So what about China?
Does anyone in the West trust China at this point? I mean, I think if there's, you know, again, just to use some crypto terminology, we used to call it rug risk in crypto. When an exchange just turns out to be a scam and vanishes underneath you, it's like getting the rug pulled out from underneath your feet, right? So it's called rug risk in crypto for a reason, because you could think you own something and then suddenly you don't. That's called getting rugged or the rug pulled. If the United States Treasury can pull out the rug from underneath Russia's feet, certainly China can pull that rug too. And I think, you know, any rational person who's a reader of The Economist or an astute observer of foreign policy over the years, watching China kind of, you know, the political winds shift within their country as well as without, like, I think it's hard to imagine feeling secure holding billions, tens or hundreds of billions of dollars worth of Chinese yuan, Chinese securities. I think that rug risk is very present, very clear and present. And if the U.S. can do it, certainly China can do it.
Yeah, and certainly trending in the wrong direction, right?
Yeah, and you know, it's like America's a very institutional country. You can kind of watch the machinations of government take place on the front page of the New York Times and very out in the open. Like if you're holding Chinese hard currency, you're really beholden to whatever is going on in Xi Jinping's brain. And I think that is not only difficult to predict, but also difficult to monitor and understand. So I think that's why the world of China and its financial systems is, they're trying. That when SWIFT, when the United States sort of pulled out SWIFT from under the feet of Russia and China, China's sort of, and I think Russia too, have created this system called CHIPS to attempt to create like a new payment rail for Chinese and potentially Russian currencies for global trade. That's a big trade lane between China and Russia. China wants oil. Russia has it. Russia wants goods. China builds a lot of stuff, but ultimately that's a big trade lane, but it is in the global sense, just a niche. And beyond that, it's just based on the behavior of these autocracies, very, very difficult to imagine one of their currencies catching on as a global reserve currency.
The HC Insider podcast is brought to you by HC Group, a retained search, intelligence, and advisory firm focused solely on the global energy and commodity sector. With 6 locations across Asia, Europe, and the Americas, and over 50 consultants. To find out more, go to our website, hcgroup.global. There, you can also sign up for our HC Insider content for more interviews and white papers on relevant trends and talent impacts in the commodities world.
Right, well, let's move to the thesis that the candidate in the wings that could be viable are cryptocurrencies. Can you give us some sense of, I guess, first of all, how the attributes of cryptocurrencies, or whichever ones you want to pick, play into that, the attributes required for a reserve currency?
So just to preface this conversation, when I left VTOL to go trade crypto and run a crypto trading business, I think a lot of people thought I was crazy. The reason why I did it was because I looked at cryptocurrencies. I've always been dabbling. I've always sort of messed around with Bitcoin and a few of the other ones, and I'd always been watching the market, but I never really understood it until there came a point where a light bulb went off and I realized sort of, aha, Bitcoin is money and Ethereum and some of these other cryptocurrencies are like commodities. You can buy them or mine them. In and of themselves, they're not necessarily that useful, but if you spend a little bit of those currencies, you burn a little bit in something that's called gas, you can refine those tokens into products and services that are useful, such as peer-to-peer money that we call Bitcoin. That's one use. Another use is a yield-bearing savings account. There's one that runs on the Ethereum network. It's called Tether. Tether is the world's largest US dollar stablecoin. There are $100 billion under management right now, which is something we can talk about in terms of what that means for the world. Is very relevant to global trade at the moment. Or you could, refine it into something like a certificate of online authenticity, proving that you own a statement or own an image or own a video. That's called an NFT, a non-fungible token. So when I realized that these things were commodities in a sense that could be bought or mined, then refined into useful things, suddenly this light bulb went off and I realized that I had a framework that I could use, an objective framework that I could use to take risk and direct trading activity in these sort of underlying ecosystems. There's not necessarily a physical good or service attached to a cryptocurrency, but as the world spends, I don't know how much you spend every day, Paul, on your computer, but I spend 10 hours a day staring at a screen. It's the world is increasingly an online world, and if we're all living in that online sort of internet-based society, why shouldn't there be online commodities just as there are physical commodities? So ultimately, I don't want to ramble on too long. I'm really curious to hear what you think about this, but I could discuss the different attributes of which cryptocurrencies I think are going to succeed and which are going to fail and why in terms of global trade or anything else you want to discuss.
Yeah, and I'll direct people to your podcast to go into some of those intricacies, and and also being a bit of a failed crypto trader, I don't think I can have any point of view. But I guess my couple of questions are, so I get the sense, right? I understand it in terms of money, right? It's a common perceived store of value, right? Everyone agrees on the rules and so forth. So it has a lot of those, whichever cryptocurrency wins or whichever couple win, I can see that. There's a couple of elements there for me that sort of question the ability to to transform into a reserve currency other than just shaving a little bit off the US dollar. And, you know, and again, we've had people on the podcast talking about even, you know, commodity transactions now going in stable coins that you mentioned. I guess one is very prosaic and the other is probably a little bit more detailed. The prosaic one is, whilst we are all online, there's a significant portion of the world that isn't, in the developing world. And I've always found it fascinating that a dollar bill in the US dollar doesn't change, right? Hasn't changed, doesn't change. Whereas every time I return to the UK or wherever it might be, my latest £5 note is out of date and I had to go to the bank to get it get it covered and so forth. So firstly is that physical world, right? There is cash remains a significant requirement for many people around the globe as a store of value. So firstly let's address that now. You know, is the world ready to move to wallets and all the rest of it in lieu of cash?
I think so. And the reason why I think so is that, you know, you say that there are large portions of the world that aren't online. And while that is indeed true, I think a rapidly growing percentage of people without, you know, traditional desktop internet access do have access to mobile phones, right? They don't necessarily have to be the iPhone 15 Pro Max, but something with Android installed on it that was made 10 years ago is more than enough to run a Bitcoin wallet. And so I think in places like sub-Saharan Africa, you know, at least in Kenya, for example, I know for a fact that mobile payments are the number one means of exchange. It's not really a cash economy. And as soon as somebody in rural Indonesia or, you know, rural Botswana has even a very technologically archaic mobile phone, they're good to go for mobile payments. And then when you consider what it would take for Bitcoin or even, you know, US dollarized value on a network like Tether to become the means of exchange, it seems like a lot, but it's really not much. I mean, if you think about it, my argument that I make over and over again is that it's not even a debate anymore. I think Bitcoin is a better store of value and means of exchange than the world's bottom 100 fiat currencies. And let's say that you're uncomfortable with Bitcoin. I think nobody would debate that the US dollar is still the best hard currency to hold, but JP Morgan and Bank of America aren't going to give you a checking account if you live in Sierra Leone. They're going to block you. And that's why Tether is so important. It's basically a US dollar checking account for people that live in unbanked regions, which is, you know, billions of people. So again, all you need is a mobile phone, and all you need to do is trust either Tether or Bitcoin. You're good to go.
The reason why I'm a failed crypto trader is that obviously after I did the episode with Zeke Fox, I sold it all thinking this is a complete scam. So my next question is...
That's how it always looks on the lows.
Yeah, exactly. I always get, you know, I'm one of those people who get washed out early. But anyway, the you know, talking of Tether, right? You are in the context of this discussion, and I appreciate this is different with Bitcoin, but with the likes of Tether, you're replacing the Fed with another group of individuals who are much far less transparent. You know, purportedly one of the founders, you know, an Italian, a former plastic surgeon with a bit of a shady history. You know, are these individuals who the world is going to trust?
Giancarlo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are these individuals the world is going to trust more than the institutions of, for example, the United States?
Well, ultimately, if you're trusting Tether, you are trusting the United States because Tether is pegged to the US dollar, right? So if Janet Yellen and friends devalue the dollar, your Tether is getting devalued too. So I guess the question is, are you going to trust Tether more than you're going to trust one of the sort of authorized, blessed institutions of dollar custody like JP Morgan or Bank of New York Mellon? No, of course not. Right, you're not going to trust the dudes, the plastic surgeon guy in Italy more than you trust Jamie Dimon, but often you don't have a choice, right? That isn't your choice. You're not deciding between a Bank of America checking account or a Tether account. You're deciding between, you know, holding currency at the local bank in Chad where you live in whatever the local currency is there, or you're looking at holding US dollars, or actually in places where Tether is really popular, like Lebanon, Argentina, Turkey, where the local currency is just in a death spiral of inflation. Like, do you trust the Turkish central banker who's been instructed by Erdogan to lower rates to combat inflation and hold your money in lira? Or do you trust the Italian guys who run Tether? Like, you trust the Italian guys who run Tether 100 times out of 100, right? So I think that's where Tether is popular.
And Tether itself is working like a currency. It's everyone believes in its store of value, right? So the question is not, as you say, is not about the Italian guy's fiscal responsibility. It's about, in terms of the US dollar, it's about whether they actually have that amount on store.
Tether went from being sketchy to much less sketchy. Like, they're audited now by proper people. You can pull up what, you know, with their transparency report and see that they hold short-term, you know, commercial paper and treasury securities against their hold. Like, it's become quite a professional operation.
Yeah, and now interest rates are not 0%, right? It all makes sense, right? But moving, I guess the more profound question is, of course, and this is a very much a live discussion in the crypto world and further afield, is the US government going to allow, right, cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, etc., to essentially, you know, take that role, right? You've got Gary Gensler at the SEC, who, and I've sat through his MIT lessons trying to understand crypto a couple of times, but now in charge of the SEC, and there's been a lot of action against various exchanges, Binance, all these groups as well. I mean, how, like, does the US government, I don't want to get into conspiracy theories here, but are they going to allow this to happen unchecked, or are they essentially irrelevant in that discussion?
I don't think they want it to happen, right? I think that if, you know, a bill came before Congress today saying, you know, option A, vote yes for US dollar supremacy and global trade status, vote option B for Bitcoin status, like, everyone would vote option A. The problem is it's hard to predict the future, as we all know from, you know, commodities trading and crypto trading. And the path to Bitcoin becoming, you know, I don't think in the next 30 years it'll become the dominant global reserve currency the way the dollar is. But for Bitcoin to take a few basis points or even a few percentage points out of the dollar's dominance right now, I think that's totally on the table for the next 5 to 10 years. And while I think that's obvious, it's actually kind of an unpopular contrarian view, and I don't think the United States is going to invest much effort in preventing that from happening, especially since I doubt most lawmakers or central bankers in America or treasury officials would agree that that's going to happen, and B, even if they did, the path to that becoming reality is not clear, so it's not even, like, obvious how you would prevent that from happening. I could tell you the way I think it's going to happen, and by the time it happens, I think it's too late for the United States to do much, frankly.
Well, I guess leading in on that, is it, just in your mind, okay, you've given some note to the timelines here, is Bitcoin definitely the candidate, or could there be alternatives?
I think it's really only Bitcoin that's the candidate. I think while, you know, Tether, it runs on a few networks, but the vast majority of Tether is transacted on Ethereum. So in some respects, other cryptocurrencies benefit from blockchain-based technology proliferating crypto, or, you know, I'd call it internet money, really. Ultimately, I think only Bitcoin is going to be accepted as money. Bitcoin is money at this point. So to me, I don't see any of the other tokens sort of threatening the dollar the way that Bitcoin does, though other tokens would benefit from a sort of blockchain-based system supporting things like Tether. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. And there is a level at which Bitcoin, there's a clarity over the rules. You know, it is the first one. There's sort of a perfection in some ways to how it's been coded. What does that mean for Bitcoin itself? I mean, there's only a limited amount. If it becomes if not the global reserve currency, a significant portion of, I mean, surely that would take it to astronomical levels if it's not, you know, if you don't count today as being such.
Yeah, I mean, I think I am still extraordinarily bullish on the price of Bitcoin. I think that it is the most obvious, you know, in commodities we call it a delta one trade, just a linear kind of price trade that I've ever seen in my entire life. Like, to me, there is no doubt in my mind that the best risk reward for any sort of capital deployment right now is long Bitcoin for 30 years as part of your IRA, which you can now access Bitcoin because of these ETFs. You mentioned Gary Gensler earlier. Gary Gensler did his very best to effectively ban cryptocurrency trading in the United States and damage cryptocurrency ecosystems, tokens, token values, exchanges. You know, he did everything he could. He started dozens of lawsuits. He's just lost again and again and again. These ETFs are getting launched not because he wanted that to happen, but in spite of his very best efforts. The other dozens of lawsuits he's filed with American taxpayer dollars that are still outstanding, he's probably going to lose 90% of them, if not more. He's already tried. He's the most inimical person to crypto in the history of American regulation, and he's failed, right? It's a very difficult thing to regulate. So ultimately, I think what's sort of apparent to me is that Bitcoin is money. The sort of chances that governments like the United States and China had to ban it have sort of, they're in the rearview mirror now. And what's left is this sort of path of adoption, maybe not in developed economies like the United States, but certainly in developing economies like El Salvador, where it's been picked up, Central African Republic. I think those are the first two of dozens of countries that will ultimately end up. Like, Bitcoin is a monetary and economic system in a box. And, you know, Germany doesn't need that. But a lot of the places where I saw VTOL trade oil, they do need that. So I wouldn't be shocked if in 10 years, when VTOL sells a cargo of oil, maybe one out of every 20 or 30 cargoes, they get some Bitcoin in return for it.
Well, Jonah, I'm sure this is going to leave people wanting to understand more, and we'll direct them to your 1000X podcast to do so. It's been a fascinating discussion. I don't think there's many people we haven't upset. I think we'll leave it there, and hopefully we can have you back on a year or so and see where these trends are developing.
Thank you so much for having me on the podcast, Paul. I know it's a bit of a tinfoil hat thesis I've got, but I appreciate your giving me the time to air it and place it in geopolitical context.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to support the show, please give us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
To find out more about HC Insider and HC Group, a search and advisory firm dedicated to the commodity markets, visit our website at www.hcgroup.global. There you can find out more about our services and our offices around the world. There you can also find more content, from interviews to insight pieces to more podcasts focused on the commodity value chains. Thanks again for listening.